This is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
Recently, at the April 2007 Eureka Springs, Arkansas UFO conference, journalist Terry Hansen was a speaker. Terry is author of an important 2000 book entitled The Missing Times, News Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up. Terry described his research of World War II and America's Office of Strategic Services, known as the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. The OSS appealed to major news media in the interest of national security to help with censorship and propaganda during the war. By September 1947, right after World War II, and only a couple of months after the alleged crash of a UFO disk between Corona and Roswell, New Mexico, the Central Intelligence Agency was formed. Over the next decades, the CIA used the World War II relationships with CBS, the New York Times, Associated Press, United Press International, and other major United States media to maintain its control over sensitive subjects, including the UFO phenomenon. By keeping CIA control over certain well-placed executives and reporters in news agencies, facts about the Central Intelligence Agency's propaganda and censorship manipulation of certain American media executives and reporters came to light 3 years after the 1972 Nixon Watergate scandal. Idaho Democrat and U.S. Senator Frank Church chaired a 1975 hearing to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities. The Church Committee investigated illegal intelligence gathering by the CIA and FBI that emerged during the Watergate investigations. Carl Bernstein, reporter at the Washington Post, working with his colleague Bob Woodward, broke open the Watergate scandal. On October 20th, 1977, Carl Bernstein was also published in the famous Rolling Stone article entitled How America's Most Powerful News Media Worked Hand in Glove with the Central Intelligence Agency and Why the Church Committee Covered It Up. Carl Bernstein reported that in addition to the New York Times, quote, CBS was unquestionably the CIA's most valuable broadcasting asset. CBS President William Paley and the CIA's Alan Dulles enjoyed an easy working and social relationship. Over the years, the CBS network provided cover for CIA employees, including at least one well-known foreign correspondent and several stringers. It supplied outtakes of news film to the CIA, established a formal channel of communication between the Washington bureau chief and the agency, gave the agency access to the CBS news film library, and allowed reports by CBS correspondents to the Washington and New York newsrooms to be routinely monitored by the CIA, unquote. One of the highly controlled subjects for decades has been the UFO phenomenon. One military voice who tried to tell the truth about UFOs, that the aerial craft were not human-made, was U.S. Marine Corps Major Donald Kehoe. As fate would have it, Terry Hansen's teacher in junior high school was Major Kehoe's sister. She talked about Major Kehoe and what he said about the astonishing aerial disc maneuvers. Later, Terry wanted to know why UFO events always seemed to be covered up or dismissed as balloons, swamp gas, or Venus by the media. During his research for the Missing Times book, he read the Church Committee's reports about direct CIA control of major media, including the New York Times and CBS. Terry also found circumstantial evidence that the CIA and mafia were behind the creation of the most notorious tabloid in America, the National Enquirer, which began in 1953, reporting more UFO incidents than any other media.
When the CIA was involved in Guatemala in the 50s, I think around 1954, the CIA was anxious for the American public to be kept ignorant of that fact. And the New York Times had a reporter down there who was covering the story. The CIA, in order to make sure the American public didn't find out what was going on, simply contacted the publisher of the New York Times and requested that he pull the reporter off the story. And so they effectively killed the story right there before the public could find out about it. Another example that just came out fairly recently, in fact, it was written up in the New York Times, had to do with the Bay of Pigs invasion in, I think it was 1962 or thereabouts. And at that time, the CIA had a relationship with the Associated Press and the UPI wire services so that it could actually place propaganda stories directly onto the international wires through those agencies. In other words, it could virtually write propaganda stories and had the cooperation of the wire services to distribute those stories worldwide. It's very well documented, I think. In the 1970s, the Church Committee in Congress held an investigation into these things. It was very well documented at the time that the New York Times, CBS, most of the major broadcast networks, in fact, had a covert relationship with the intelligence community and carried out all sorts of assignments ranging from providing cover for intelligence agents to censoring the news to distributing propaganda and so on. So this was all widely exposed. It was written up in the Columbia Journalism Review and then later in some popular publications such as Rolling Stone and some of those. And then eventually the New York Times, after it had been exposed, did a series of articles in which they confessed that they had done this. The news media, at least up through the mid-60s and 70s probably, was doing this kind of thing behind the scenes.
And that the justification was always in the interest of national security?
That's correct.
Now, could you explain the origin and evolution that led up to the creation of the National Enquirer?
Yeah, that's a very interesting story because it does actually begin in World War II. There was a well-known Italian language newspaper on the East Coast called Il Progresso, and it was owned by a family called the Pope family, P-O-P-E, and Jean Pope Sr., I believe, started the paper, was a very influential East Coast power broker, and he was really supportive of Mussolini during World War II, and that got the attention of the U.S. intelligence community, the OSS at the time, and they decided that they would try to infiltrate his newspaper to find out, you know, why he was supporting Mussolini. Well, I think it actually turned out that he just wanted a better relationship between Italy and the U.S., and he wasn't so much a backer of Mussolini. But at any rate, this was the first time that Il Progresso came to the attention of the intelligence community, possibly as a result of their monitoring the Jean Pope family. They became aware of his son, Jean Pope Jr. He was a fairly bright young man. He graduated from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology at age 19 in engineering, so it gives you an indication of how smart he must have been. Around 1950, there was a kind of internal family struggle over control of Il Progresso, and for some reason, Jean Pope Jr. lost out in that struggle and was sort of forced to go elsewhere, you know, separate himself from the paper. And he found a job in, of all places, the CIA's Psychological Warfare Unit. That was 1951 when he started working for the CIA. About 1952, Jean Pope Jr. leaves the CIA. He's now about 25 years old, and he purchases a newspaper called the New York Enquirer, which was part of the Hearst Empire, for about $75,000 using what he described as an interest-free loan for $20,000 as a down payment.
And he was also working for the CIA at the same time?
Well, we don't really know that for sure. Officially, he left the CIA, but there are some reasons to think that he maintained some contact with them. He has kind of a mysterious background, and from what I've read, those who have tried to find government documents on Pope have been blocked for national security reasons. So his relationship, his true relationship with the government, I don't think has been fully revealed at this time. But at any rate, he somehow managed to come up with some money, quite a bit of money, to buy the Hearst New York Enquirer, and then he later renamed that the National Enquirer, which of course is well known to many people now. The paper that he bought was actually in bad financial shape, and it required kind of a continual infusion of money to keep it afloat. I think the total funds needed to make the newspaper profitable was about $250,000. Now, that may not sound a lot in today's dollars, but if you adjust it for inflation, that's about $1.6 million in 2003 dollars. So it was a big chunk of change for a 25-year-old kid to come up with. And it raises a question, naturally, as to where he got the money. There's been a lot of speculation about that.
And the implication is that he might never officially have left the CIA, that he might have already been doing this as an assignment to get in this newspaper, and that that's where the money came from?
Well, that's certainly a possibility, because you have to ask the question, how did somebody that young come up with such a large amount of money? And we know for a fact that in the early 1950s, the CIA was spending very lavishly on a broad range of media assets, as they called them. And it would have been very natural for someone who just came out of the CIA's psychological warfare division to appeal to the CIA for funding, or to at least be qualified to obtain funding for some type of propaganda operation. Some people have said that the funding came from his godfather, who is mobster Frank Costello. Frank Costello was also connected with the OSS during World War II, where he did a lot of things for the intelligence community. So any way you look at it, there are these ties between the National Enquirer and the intelligence community.
And the mafia.
Yeah, well, the mafia too. But of course, the mafia and the intelligence community have been working together for many, many years as well. So they're all sort of one big family. But anyway, another connection to the intelligence community is that one of the first employees of the National Enquirer was a man by the name of Bill Bates, and he was a former OSS officer. So you find these consistent ties between the intelligence community and National Enquirer from a very early point in the paper's founding.
And is it fair to say that when you look back at that period of history that you researched, that the Central Intelligence Agency was essentially trying to wire so that they had influence and control on all the major media?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about that. And one person commented to me that he thought it was kind of a stretch to believe that they would go to the trouble of funding a newspaper and all this. But actually, it was a fairly common practice for the CIA. And when economist John Kenneth Galbraith went to India as ambassador under John Kennedy, he found a newspaper very much like the National Enquirer in India that he later discovered was financed by the CIA. So it was this type of psychological warfare trick was something the CIA was doing in other parts of the world. It provides some sort of circumstantial support for the theory that the Enquirer was a CIA operation.
If it were, could you now talk about how there seemed to be a concentration on Earth mysteries, specifically UFO stories in the National Enquirer?
People who are familiar with the history of the UFO controversy are probably aware of something called the Robertson Panel. In 1953, the CIA got involved in debunking UFO reports. They put together a panel chaired by a scientist called H.P. Robertson, and Robertson was a very high-level scientific intelligence man. He was a leading physicist as well as an intelligence officer and had played an important role in World War II. So Robertson's recommendation was that, or the recommendation of his panel was that UFOs be debunked by a covert mass media program of training and debunking, as they called it. So this, of course, was about almost the same time that the National Enquirer was getting started. And the National Enquirer, for many years thereafter, was one of the very few national U.S. newspapers to consistently cover the UFO topic. What's interesting about it is that most of their stories were quite accurate. They were sensational by their very nature, but they were quite accurate. Many of them were written by a journalist named Bob Pratt. The stories were true for the most part, but they mixed them in with a kind of the sort of tabloid mix of celebrity stories and trashy, sensationalistic topics, so that anyone who saw these stories in the National Enquirer would make a kind of mental connection between UFOs and rather dubious, sensationalistic reporting. And so it cast the whole subject into disrepute. And of course, that's exactly what psychological warfare people do. They use these types of ploys to muddy the waters and confuse people about what's really going on.
Which is exactly the office that Mr. Pope, founder of the National Enquirer, was working in the CIA.
Well, that's right. So it gets even more interesting when you follow the story a little bit further. Of course, in the 60s and 70s, the National Enquirer made sensational UFO-related news coverage sort of a laughingstock, and it kind of set the pattern for other tabloid newspapers to come, which also, I think, had peripheral links to the intelligence community, although it's maybe a little less clear than with the Enquirer. During the 1970s, Pope was having difficulty getting the National Enquirer into the Winn-Dixie grocery store chain and got help from, of all people, Melvin Laird, who was Nixon's Secretary of Defense. Laird arranged a tour of the White House, the Nixon White House, for Winn-Dixie grocery store executives. They were so impressed with Pope's clout with the White House that they finally agreed to let the Winn-Dixie grocery store chain carry the National Enquirer. In a story about this by Forbes magazine, a reporter asked Pope about this connection he had with the White House and why he had such clout with the national defense establishment and all that, and he said, well, it's just politics. One hand washes the other. The implication, I think, is that Pope was doing something for either the Nixon White House or Secretary of Defense, and that in return they were helping him get his paper out into as many places as possible. So now the final footnote to this whole amazing story is that when Pope died in 1988, he was now one of America's wealthiest men. And who of all people gave the eulogy at his funeral but Defense Secretary Melvin Laird, who had been Defense Secretary under Nixon. So again, you have this interesting tie between the national security establishment and the National Enquirer. So you can kind of connect the dots there, and it looks fairly suspicious, I'd say.
The 2 + 2 = 4, that the National Enquirer was a central intelligence agency psychological warfare project.
Yeah, that's the way it certainly looks to me. The fingerprints are all over it. It's hard to come to any other reasonable conclusion. There's no doubt that the National Enquirer had a huge impact on the way many people in the public at large and also in the journalistic establishment see the UFO topic. I mean, by connecting flying saucers and UFOs with this kind of trashy tabloid reporting, it's made this link in people's minds that UFOs are, by definition, disreputable and questionable material. And, of course, that's exactly what the Robertson panel set out to achieve in 1953. Now, the CIA's official position, I think, is that they never really followed through on the Robertson panel's recommendations, but a letter has come to light through recent research that makes it clear that they were, in fact, doing this sort of thing, because one member of the Robertson panel in 1966 wrote a letter, a handwritten letter, to a fellow CIA associate in which he confessed that he had helped organize a CBS television broadcast around the Robertson panel's conclusions. This was a famous broadcast narrated by Walter Cronkite. And we also know, of course, that CBS at this time had a very close working relationship with the intelligence community. So it was not at all surprising that if the CIA wanted to debunk UFOs, it would appeal to organizations such as CBS to help them do that. And this letter really establishes that the Robertson panel's recommendations were being carried out at least as late as 1966, which is 13 years after the recommendations were first made.
Why do you think that so much effort has been put into discrediting and misinformation and psychological warfare to keep the media and the public at an arm's length distance from what leaked government documents call extraterrestrial biological entities?
Well, that's really the $64 million question that, you know, the question everybody would like to have the answer to. I think initially there was quite obvious concern expressed in a lot of internal government documents about the surveillance of U.S. military installations, nuclear weapons facilities, and so forth by flying saucers or UFOs. And so there was naturally, in the minds of the military establishment, there was a concern about potential invasion by some unknown force. And in fact, early on, President Eisenhower actually made a denial on the front page of the New York Times, saying that the world was not being invaded by flying saucers from outer space. So it was clearly a topic of great concern at that time, and on up into the mid-1970s, the flying saucers or UFOs were still flying over our nuclear weapons facilities and interfering with ICBMs and that sort of thing, according to military personnel. So there does seem to be this kind of issue about surveillance and interference with military facilities. There may be other issues as well having to do with economic considerations, military hardware considerations.
You can add animal mutilations and human abductions to the list that the government would have been so concerned that no one know about until they had control over it. And we're talking in May of 2007, and the human abduction syndrome is still reported, and so are worldwide bloodless animal mutilations.
Yep, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I think the defense establishment wants to project an image of being in control, and they're obviously not in control and haven't been for quite a long time, and I think they don't want to confess that to the public because that's the source of their power. And I suppose another aspect is just concern about what the public reaction would be if they came out and said that, yeah, these things are going on and there's really very little we can do about them.
Are you convinced that the presence of more than one extraterrestrial or some kind of non-human intelligence is at work on the planet now and has been perhaps for millennia?
Well, it looks that way to me, Linda. You know, I've read just many thousands of these accounts from what I think are credible sources, and I don't think you can come to any other conclusion that there's some form of intelligence more advanced than human beings that has been involved with our affairs for quite a long time. I think we first became aware of this in a big way following World War II, but I suspect it's been going on for much longer than that, probably many thousands of years, if not a good deal longer.
Do you think that the CIA and other intelligence agencies still have the fix in the wiring of media such as the New York Times, CBS, and so forth?
I think they do. I haven't seen any real change in media policy about this in the United States anyway. So I think there is still a large, very strong tendency to try to keep the subject under wraps. But it's a question of whether they really have much credibility with the public anymore, because if you look at the public opinion polls, it's pretty clear that most people don't believe what the government is saying about the issue. So in a sense, they've already lost the battle, even though they continue fighting it using the old methods that they've had for so many years.
But do you personally think that in our lifetime, that the truth will finally come to the world, that we're not alone, that other advanced intelligences are here interacting with the Earth and have been for millennia?
Well, that's a good question. It depends on who you look to for your source of what is true. I mean, if you look to the political establishment, they're not very good at telling the truth about anything, much less UFOs. So I think it's sort of against their nature to speak the truth about almost anything. But I see this as a microcosm of a much broader political problem in the United States right now, which is a battle for an open society. There's a battle going on between people who want to continue an open democratic society and those who want to try to suppress that. We see this manifesting in a lot of other issues outside the UFO area, but the UFOs are part of that whole problem of secrecy in government and unwillingness to run our country in a democratic fashion.
And tell the truth.
And tell the truth. That's right.
In 1966, the CBS network aired a so-called documentary entitled UFOs, Friend, Foe, or Fantasy, narrated by Walter Cronkite. The documentary debunked the UFO phenomenon. Terry Hansen points out that shortly after the CBS broadcast, one of the CIA Robertson panel's astronomers, Thornton Page, Ph.D., wrote a letter to the Robertson panel's secretary, Fred Durant. Dr. Thornton admits in the letter that he, quote, helped organize the CBS TV show around the Robertson panel's conclusions, unquote. The letter is dated September 8, 1966, and reads as if Dr. Thornton is dismissing the entire disk phenomenon as if it were meaningless. Here is the astronomer's entire letter, handwritten while he was riding on a New Haven, Connecticut train. Quote, "Dear Fred, I remember Q building and flying saucers well. Have used the latter to teach astronomy students since 1958, and helped organize the CBS TV show around the Robertson panel conclusions, plus more recent student interests. The sociological aspects still intrigue me, particularly the eastward drift of UFO activity around the world and the God-angel image transferred to UFO crews. It's too bad that the U.S. Air Force still is accused of, quote, holding something back, unquote, and that this, quote, serious business, unquote, is a bestseller. For more information about the news media complicity and the UFO cover-up, Terry Hansen's book, The Missing Times, can be ordered directly from the book's electronic publisher, Libris Online Bookstore. The hot link, phone numbers, and hard mail address are given in my earthfiles.com report at www.earthfiles.com. Terry Hansen's important book is also available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble Books.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.